things morally right, but religiously wrong. We need to know the difference. Many people equate being moral with being religious or Christian. Morality alone, however, does not constitute the religion of Christ. In Acts 10, beginning in verse 1, there was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian regiment, a devout man, and one who feared God with all his household, who gave alms generously to the people and prayed to God always. Cornelius was a morally upright man. But we continue reading in verse 3, about the ninth hour of the day, he saw clearly in a vision an angel of God coming in and saying to him, Cornelius. And when he observed him, he was afraid and said, What is it, Lord? So he said to him, Your prayers and your alms have come up for a memorial before God. Surely then, God obviously respected the prayers of Cornelius. But we go on. The angel said, Now send men to Joppa and send for Simon, whose surname is Peter. He is lodging with Simon, a tanner, whose house is by the sea. He will tell you what you must do. There was something that needed to be done by Cornelius, of which he was unaware. And thus, if you don't know that there is something you must do, you can't do it. You won't know to do it. And so the angel tells him, send for Peter, and he will tell you what you must do. Now later, Peter gives an account of this same event, and here's how Peter characterizes this particular statement of the angel. He told us how he had seen an angel standing in his house, who said to him, send men to Joppa, and call for Simon, whose surname is Peter, who will tell you words by which you and all your household will be saved. So Cornelius was a morally upright man. God respected his prayers, yet Cornelius needed to be saved. And so Cornelius was morally right, morally upright man, but he was not a saved man, and thus what generally characterized him was morally right, but yet he was religiously wrong. He needed to be made right with God in a religious or spiritual sense. So we see that religion and morality, though they are closely connected, they're not interchangeable. One can be morally upright and yet still not be religiously right before God. Furthermore, some think that if a thing is moral, it is necessarily something which may be incorporated into the worship and or work of the church. Well, then, what's wrong with it from a moral standpoint, they might ask? Well, there may not be anything wrong with it from a moral standpoint, but that does not mean that the church needs to be engaged in it. Some folks do not seem to understand why Christians do not practice certain things in a religious context. We're not just talking about what Christians do collectively, but it can also be true of what Christians do individually. As far as religion is concerned, they can do certain things, even though morally they can do certain other things. These things that they can do morally are not necessarily things that they can do religiously or in a religious context. They will look at a particular practice and not finding anything wrong with it morally, ask, well, why don't you use the piano? Why don't you use the organ? Why don't you use this or that? Or why can't you play along with your singing? Or why can't you have a spaghetti supper to raise money? Or why can't you do this or that? Because there's nothing morally wrong with it, is there? Well, we need to understand again the difference between religion and morality. The reason is that some things may be morally right, but religiously wrong. Now, this is a biblical principle, one that we see in the Bible, and I want to talk about a few examples to make sure that we understand the principle as we see it illustrated in the Bible. Consider, first of all, Nadab and Abihu. In Leviticus 10, verses 1 and 2, that Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer, that's basically a pan for incense, and put fire in it. That is, they put fire attached to the incense there. Put incense on it and offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. So fire went out from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. Were they guilty of some immoral activity? No. Nothing immoral about kindling a fire. Fire had been kindled by Abraham and all manner of godly people in the past. They were actually commanded to start fires and to burn sacrifices unto God. Nothing immoral about kindling a fire. But the fire they used was from an unauthorized source. God had authorized the place to get the fire. But that's where they were to get it. And they didn't get the fire from that source. It was profane or strange, or as the English Standard Version says, it was unauthorized. And so they offered to God something morally right, but religiously wrong. It wasn't an immoral act at all, but it was an unauthorized act where their religion is concerned, or where their practice as priests was concerned, because that involved religion and not just morality. Consider also Moses and the rock. The children of Israel, in Numbers 20, verses 1 and 2, then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh. And Miriam died there and was buried there. There was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. And the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, if only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. Why have you brought up the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness that we and our animals should die here? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink. Now, the whole time that these people lived in Egypt, they were complaining about their mistreatment. And their cries went up unto God. And God raised up Moses and delivered the people from that awful place. And all they can do in the wilderness is complain about what they don't have that they did have over there. They had grain, they had figs, they had vines, they had pomegranates over there, they had leeks, they had onions. But yet, they were compelled to make bricks without straw. Or at least they were not provided the straw. They had to go out and gather the straw themselves, putting additional work on them. And so God was carrying them to that place filled with milk and honey, a place where they would be plenty, but they were impatient. And thus they were complaining about what they didn't have here in the wilderness. So Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle meeting, and they fell on their faces. And the Lord appeared to them. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, gather the congregation together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water from them out of the rock, and give drink to the congregation and their animals. Now this had happened once before, and on that occasion God had said, take the rod and strike the rock. But this time he doesn't say that. He says, speak to the rock. You know, I feel kind of foolish speaking to a rock. But when God commands you to do something, you do it. You don't feel foolish doing it if God commanded it. So speak to the rock, and it will yield its water. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him, and Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Now God didn't tell him to strike the rock at all. And not content with striking it once, he struck it twice. And actions unauthorized by God on this particular occasion. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. This was the water of Meribah. By the way, that's a Hebrew word meaning contention. This was the water of contention, because the children of Israel contended with the Lord, and he was hallowed among them. Well, nothing immoral about striking a rock. You don't have to come forward and repent if you happen to strike a rock sometime during the week. It's not an immoral act. Moses would not have sinned any other time in the world if he had struck a rock. But on this particular occasion, as a matter of fact, God had told him to strike one before. But on this particular occasion, God told him to speak to the rock. He didn't tell him to strike it. Thus striking the rock was unauthorized. And not only did he strike the rock, he struck it twice. And Saul attempted not to Jehovah God, but to himself and Aaron, must we give you water to drink? Now they weren't giving the people water to drink. God did. Now God caused the water to come out of the rock, just did promise. But Moses and Aaron suffered for it because they could not enter the promised land during their lifetime because of that failure on their part. Thus Moses did something that was morally right, but religiously wrong. It was religiously wrong in that it was not a part of the command that God issued to him on this particular occasion. It was not a part of the God-appointed means of providing water for the people. Well, another, consider David, or really Uzzah. I changed it on some of these charts. I didn't change it on this one. Uzzah and the ox cart. In 1 Chronicles 13, 5 and 6, so David gathered all Israel together from Shamor in Egypt to as far as the entrance of Hamath to bring the ark of God from Kirjath-Jearim. And David and all Israel went up to Bala, to Kirjath-Jearim, which belonged to Judah, to bring up from there the ark of God, the Lord, who dwells between the cherubim where his name is proclaimed. You might remember that during the days of Samuel and Eli, the people took the Ark of the Covenant in the battle against the Philistines and the Philistine folks, because they were not authorized to have it out there. It was to be in the most holy place. That's where it was to be. And they took it out to battle, and it was captured, and now David decided, well, you know, we need it back. Saul never did go and get it during the 40 years that he reigned as king. They didn't know what to get it. So they carried the Ark of God on a new cart from the house of Benadab, and Uzzah and Ahio drove the cart. Then David and all Israel played music before God with all their might, with singing on harps, on stringed instruments, and tambourines, on cymbals, and with trumpets. And when they came to Shaddon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to hold the ark where the oxen stumbled. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and he struck him, because he put his hand to the ark and he died there before God. God had said, don't you touch the ark. Nobody was authorized to touch the ark. Well, how are we going to carry it? God had told them when he gave them instructions to build that ark, I want you to put these gold rings in the corners of the ark. And I want you to take these poles and insert these poles through those rings, and when you get ready to move, that's how you're going to transport the Ark of the Covenant. You're going to put the poles, the staves through these rings, rings on each side, and four men will lift up that ark and carry it. I've often wondered, how did they get it on the ox cart? The problem is, you know, I've got these rings here, let's put a couple poles through these rings, lift it up on the ark of the ox cart. But the ox cart was not authorized, is it? Nothing immoral about the use of an ox cart. No, nothing wrong with that. They probably use ox carts all day long. I really appreciate Jackie's lesson on this, where he goes into great detail and preached us about that ox cart. There were actually about six ox carts, I think, that were initially issued to the people, and one of them was unused for a long time. So they said, let's use this ox cart for something. Nothing immoral about it at all. Nothing bad happened to the people who used those other ox carts, because I believe they were ordained by God to be used. But they weren't ordained by God to be used to transport the Ark of the Covenant. God had said the Ark was to be carried on poles inserted through those rings. Thus, Uzzah did something morally right, but religiously wrong. And I say morally right, there's nothing morally wrong in using an ox cart. But he and Ahio, in driving that ox cart on which was placed that Ark of the Covenant, were doing something that was religiously wrong. And Uzzah suffered for it when he touched the Ark against God's command. Well, there are other things that are morally right but religiously wrong that we want to talk about, and there are many things that could be used. I'm just using these as some illustrations, some examples here. Peace and fancy are morally right, and Brad is certainly glad about that. He has to be involved in some kind of a job that involves some immoral substance. I don't think he's going to be involved in any kind of a heroin sales or anything like that, but there's nothing wrong with fancy, morally speaking. Some of us like Coke a little better, but nothing wrong with fancy. And pizza? Oh, certainly nothing wrong with pizza as long as it doesn't have any anchovies and mushrooms on it. There's nothing immoral about eating pizza and drinking Pepsi. But the Lord has specifically authorized unleavened bread and fruit of the vine for the Lord's Supper. So, morally right, eat pizza and drink Pepsi. But it would be religiously wrong to eat pizza and drink Pepsi the Lord's Supper. Or anything else but unleavened bread and fruit of the vine. Well, why is that? Well, they're under what the Lord authorized. In Matthew 26, verse 26 beginning, as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, "Hey, eat, this is my body." Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. For this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins." And so when Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, he took the unleavened bread, which is the only bread they could have possibly had, or they would have been morally wrong, or spiritually wrong, that is, because all the leaven was to be put out of the house during the days of unleavened bread, which you want. And so, that's all they had, so that's what he used. Celebrating a federal holiday is morally right. Nothing wrong with celebrating a federal holiday from a moral standpoint. You know, there are several, at least, federal holidays. We just had one the other day. President's Day. And, you know, I had all kinds of sales at the stores and everything. And some closed their business. The federal government shut down all of its businesses in order to honor the president. Nothing wrong with that. There's several other federal holidays. You've got Thanksgiving, and no mail delivered on Thanksgiving. You've got Christmas Day, no mail delivered on Christmas Day, or whatever day, if it happens to fall on a Sunday, that they observe that. Nothing wrong with taking a day off if your boss gives you the day off. Nothing wrong with taking a day's wages if you get paid for it. There's nothing immoral about a day on which to have a big meal with friends and family and to exchange gifts with one another. Rather, neither is there anything immoral about studying the birth of Jesus. You know, you can study the birth of Jesus any day of the year. Why? But it's a Bible subject. It's a Bible subject that needs to be studied. If December 25th happens to fall on a Sunday and you're studying the birth of Jesus, there's nothing wrong with that. I heard the wife of one gospel preacher told me that it happened to be December 25th on a Sunday, and her lesson for the children just happened to fall on the birth of Jesus, and somebody came in and she was teaching her children on the birth of Jesus, not because it's December 25th, but because that's where they were in the literature. And she was criticized because she was teaching about the birth of Jesus on December 25th. Nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with teaching that Jesus was born on December 25th, and we don't know when Jesus was born. As a matter of fact, it's pretty certain that he wasn't born on December 25th or in any winter month. So to affirm that is to affirm something that can't be proved and probably isn't true. And again, nothing wrong with having a big meal with friends and family and exchanging gifts with one another. How's the matter? The only day to which the Lord has attached any religious significance is the first day of the week. We have no business attaching any religious significance to any other day of the week, month, or year. It's all upright. Again, nothing wrong with a federal holiday. If the government wants to set aside a day, one day a year, two or three days a year, a special day, then let the federal employees off. Nothing wrong with that. If you want to do something special on that day, nothing wrong with that, as long as you don't want to do something that God hasn't authorized you to do, such as take the Lord's Supper on a day of the week other than the first. The religious significance is attached to the first day of the week. That's the day on which we break bread. That's the day on which we lay by in store. Because that's the day that's authorized for those two practices. So it is religiously wrong to set aside another day and make it a religious obligation and attach to it religious traditions and myths. And it doesn't matter if you're an individual Christian or if you're talking about an individual Christian or a collective Christian, a local church. No authority to have religious significance to any day other than the first day of the week. Why is that? Well, comes back to 27, on the first day of the week, when the disciples came together, break bread, Paul, ready to depart the next day, spoke to them and continued his message until midnight. I appreciate many things that Gary Eubanks has said over the years and written, but an article he sent to me a few months ago made the point in discussing examples and the authority of examples that it's probably not nearly as important that we know they came together on the first day of the week to break bread as it is that Luke tells us that they came together on the first day of the week to break bread. And I thought that was an interesting point. Why would Luke bother telling us that they came together on the first day of the week to break bread if it was merely an exercise of choice on their part when they could have chosen the seventh day or the third day or the second day or something? If they could have chosen some other day of the week, why would Luke tell us that they chose the first day of the week? But when you consider that it was the first day of the week on which Jesus was raised, it was the first day of the week on which Jesus first appeared to the apostles, it was the first day of the week on which Jesus secondly appeared to the apostles, it was the first day of the week when the Holy Spirit fell on the apostles, and they were baptized in the Holy Spirit, and began to speak in words that the Spirit gave them utterance, and that the gospel was first preached as factual matters, and the conditions of salvation were for the first time announced publicly, and people publicly accepted those conditions and were added by the Lord to His church. When you consider the significance that is attached in other places to the first of the week, plus the fact that when Jesus entered through the Lord's Supper, He said, "I will not henceforth drink of this fruit of the vine till I drink it new with you on that day in my Father's kingdom." What day was He talking about? We learned what they were talking about by Acts 20 verse 7. The first day of the week. So that's the only day that the New Testament attaches any religious significance to, and so we cannot attach any religious significance to any other day of the week. Now, we can come together any other day of the week to engage in activities such as singing and teaching and preaching and praying and Bible study. But the only time we can come together to break bread, to eat the Lord's Supper, and to lay by the store, is on the first day of the week. Instrumental music is morally right. There's nothing immoral about playing the mechanical instrument of music. I took, back in 1979, I believe it was, I took one piano lesson, and the instructor seemingly impressed with my ability, and I was looking forward to taking that, but then my schedule changed because of something else, and I couldn't put it into my schedule, so I never had another lesson. But he seemed to think that I had some propensity for it, and there was a lot about it that was confusing to me. But I would have liked to have continued that. I got a guitar for Christmas one year back in the late 60s. I tried playing Langford a few times, but even when I sang along, people couldn't tell what I was playing, and so I kind of gave up on that. Nothing immoral about music. Matter of fact, we see music used extensively, instrumental music used extensively in the Old Testament by the Jews. But the Lord has not authorized their use in the worship of the local church. Christians are simply not authorized to use instrumental music in worship. He hasn't authorized it. So it's morally right, nothing wrong with the morally, but it's religiously wrong to add instrumental music to the worship of God and singing praises. Why? Well, because of what God said in His book. Ephesians 5:19, speaking one another, songs, hymns, and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in the hearts of the Lord. Nothing said about playing on an instrument there. In Colossians 3:16-17, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and praising your hearts to the Lord. And whatever you do, in word, that teaching, or deed, that practice, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through Him. That doesn't mean that, just attach the name of the Lord to it and you're all right. That's the way a lot of people think about doing something in the name of the Lord. Well, I do it in the name of the Lord. I heard about one fellow, it was said of him that every time he did something, he would say in the name of the Lord. And I disputed. I said, I don't believe he can. I don't believe it's possible to say in the name of the Lord every time you do something, because every time you say something, you're doing something. But anyway, that was his idea of doing things in the name of the Lord. Every time he did something, in the name of the Lord. In the name of the Lord. Well, if that's all it meant, then why would... It wouldn't really mean anything, would it? Just say you're doing it in the name of the Lord, that's all right. Now you have to do it in the name of the Lord. You have to have the authority of the Lord behind it, or you're not doing it in the name of the Lord. Anybody can knock on the door of a house and say, open up in the name of the law. But if they are not a legally appointed representative of the law, you don't have to open up. They have no right to demand that you open up. Only a person with a badge of authority has the right to demand that. And nobody has the right to expect you to do anything, teaching or practice, for which they cannot produce authority from God. That's what doing something in the name of the Lord means. And as I've noticed from time to time, that's direct statement, proved example, or necessary implication. The act of Christians eating a common meal together is more than right. Many of us eat common meals together every Sunday afternoon. Not everybody gets to go. Sometimes people are absent. Sometimes people just go on home instead. But, you know, we don't make it a binding thing. We don't exclude or include anybody particularly. We just, some of us just go out and eat a common meal together. Cheddar's or Logan's or F&S or El Sombrero. Nothing morally wrong with that. Nothing immoral about Christians eating a common meal together. But the Lord has not authorized the local church to come together to eat a common meal. The only meal they're authorized to come together to eat as a church is the Lord's Supper. It's a communion meal, it's a memorial meal, it's a covenant meal. There's a number of different ways that it can be described in keeping with the scriptures. But one thing it is not. It's not a common meal. It's not to be eaten for the satisfaction of physical hunger. I remember hearing back over in Alabama, young fellow preaching for the big liberal church. It kind of made us mad because he was on television every Sunday. They were playing his sermons and he was saying the most outlandish things. And talking about the Lord's Supper, he talked about how he took a big old piece of that unleavened bread because he wanted to really show the Lord's death. So what about the fellow behind him? Didn't get it. Somebody might think he was eating the food of satisfying hunger. No, it's a memorial meal, a covenant meal. There are a number of different ways that can be described. But it's not a common meal. It's not eating to satisfy hunger. As a matter of fact, the Apostle Paul told us what it's for, and I'll notice that in just a second. Likewise, the church is certainly authorized to provide food for those of the faith that are hungry and in need. Yes? If somebody of the faith is hungry and in need, yes, the church can feed them, provide food for them. But it is religiously wrong for the church as the church to organize and promote the eating of common meals. Why? Well, because of what the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11. Verse 17 beginning, and given these instructions, I do not praise you, since you come together not for the better, but for the worse. For first of all, when you come together as a church, he's not talking about what to do when they come together as Christians. But when you come together as a church, as a congregation, I hear that there are divisions among you, in part I believe it, for there must also be factions among you, that those who are approved may be recognized among you. Therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. Well, they thought it was. But what they were eating was not the Lord's Supper. For in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others. And one is hungry and another is drunk. What, do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I do not praise you. What's he talking about? He's talking about eating for the satisfaction of hunger. Because so many of them were eating it all up. And I think it's just unleavened bread. I don't know that they had potatoes out there. It's beside the point. They were eating to satisfy hunger, and though some were hungry, and others were getting drunk or getting full. He didn't praise them in that. For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. When he says this is broken for you, I believe he's talking about the bread that he had just broken. bread, when he gave thanks and broke it, what did he break? He broke the bread. He didn't break his body. But the bread is representative of his body. The bread is broken. He is broken so they can eat healthy. Do this in remembrance of me. So, because of that, common meals are unauthorized. Morally right, religiously wrong. Wholesome recreation is morally right. Nothing wrong with wholesome recreation. Nothing immoral about wholesome recreation at all. These kinds of activities are the responsibility of the home, though. The church has not been charged with the entertainment of youth. The church has not been charged with providing entertainment and or recreation for its members, for their children, or for anybody else. You know, I've heard of some churches, some congregations that wear the name of Christ. They've got a sign outside that says Church of Christ. And they not only provide entertainment, but they'll charge for it. To raise money. That's two in practice right there. Two things for which they're not authorized. One, they're not authorized to do anything to raise money for the church. Great, didn't lay by on the first day of the week. Like that, so on. Number two, they're not authorized to provide entertainment for recreation. When they do it at a charge, see, that's a twofold religious sin. It is religiously wrong for the church to organize and promote recreation for its members and or their children, let alone anyone else. There would be nothing morally wrong with sponsoring a scout troop by providing a place for it to meet. There would be nothing wrong, morally wrong with sponsoring a baseball team and buying uniforms. But it would be religiously wrong for a local church to provide for these morally acceptable recreational features. Why? Because it doesn't fall within the purview of the work of the local church. The reason is that the work of the church is threefold. Providing for the edification of saints, that I believe is the main, the primary function of the local church. That's what we see it doing from its great inception, providing for the edification of saints as they came together continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine, the fellowship, and the breaking of bread and prayers. Why? To edify one another. But also to provide the physical needs of saints as necessary, which we certainly see them doing that. And thirdly, supporting the preaching of the gospel to the extent of its ability. Now, just because we don't have the ability, that doesn't mean that we can say, well, you know, you other churches, y'all send money to us and we'll forward it on to the preacher. So-called sponsoring church arrangements that so many brethren are practicing. No, to the extent of our ability. And if we don't have the ability, we don't have the obligation. Authority plus opportunity plus ability equals responsibility. And if we don't have the authority, we can't do it. If we don't have the authority and don't have the ability, we can't do it. If we don't have the authority, if we have the authority, have the ability, but we don't have the opportunity, no case to do it. Have to have all three in order to do that. And that's the extent of the work of the church. And Colossians chapter 3, verse 17 again, whatever you do, in word or deed, do all. In the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father for you. So if there's no authority for it, if there's no direct statement concerning it, if there's no approved apostolic example of the local church doing it, if there's nothing from which we can necessarily infer that it can be done, then it's simply wrong, religiously wrong, though there may not be anything wrong with it morally. And so we can't do just whatever we might want to do. There may be hurt feelings sometimes when a member of the congregation asks the congregation, would you do this for me? And well, no, we can't do that. There's no authority for that. And it's sad that there are hurt feelings. Somebody just doesn't understand that there's some things that the whole congregation simply is not right to do. It's not that we just don't want to do it. But we don't want to do what is not authorized. Our pastor wants to do what is not authorized. Even if it's morally right, nothing wrong with a scout troop, but we have no business providing for the meetings of the scout troop. Nothing wrong with baseball, but we have no business establishing a baseball team to pull young people in, or to keep our young people busy if we had enough to form a team. There's no authority for it. Nothing morally wrong with it. But it's religiously wrong if there's no authority.